Welcome to In the Margins. I'm your host, Ralph Newell. Joining me today is Dr. Jacqueline Battalora. She is the author of Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. She's also an attorney, professor of sociology at St. Xavier University in Chicago. So today, like I said, I want to talk about whiteness, the taboo of privilege, white awareness, white fragility. These are terms that, you know, have a negative connotation to them, and to others, they are, you know, apt descriptions. So again, I want to welcome you, and you have a very interesting background. You're originally from Scotland and Belgium, but you grew up in Texas. So you came here at a young age. So at that time when you got here, were you old enough to see and understand racial difference and inequality in the U.S.?
You know what, I certainly learned very quickly the arrangement of people once I moved to Texas from Belgium. In Belgium, the sort of ostracized groups were largely referred to as gypsies. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who were, you know, viewed as criminals and you were to be cautious of. But when I came to Southern Texas, I certainly very quickly learned the new arrangement. I wasn't conscious in the second grade about, you know, sort of a framing or understanding it as a system, even seeing it as a racial structure. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I didn't have the capacities at that point to understand it in that sort of way. But I've recently looked at some journals where I can see my little self learning about people in this mm-hmm. new environment and how people were positioned relative to each other.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that yourself as a second grader, because I often look at, you know, the world right now through the lens of my children. You know, they're older now, they're 20, and about when my youngest is about to be 18 in 2 weeks. But I remember when they were in second grade, like you're saying, and they would come home with stories about things that happened in school and experiences they had. And they were so naive to me. And I mean, I'll say innocent, not naive. They were innocent. But yeah. They would say things and their mother or I would ask, okay, what color was she? Or what was he? You know, trying to put things in context. And they would get very upset with that, of like, why are you asking about that? Color doesn't matter, you know. And it's interesting that, you know, I'm saying domestic children versus an immigrant person like yourself didn't see this stuff. And then as you got older, you start to see it.
Absolutely.
And now, you know.
Well, we're given, especially as young people, mm-hmm. we're given these myths and these meta narratives about this country called the United States of America, where everybody who will work hard has a fair chance, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And we don't see color. I mean, things that if you're into just literally scratching the surface of diversity, equity, and inclusion or belonging work, you know, are simply not true. But to help people see how false those are is, to some people, it seems to be experienced as an affront to being mm-hmm. American. And I see that as one of our biggest projects in this moment. Because I will not concede patronage to that view of America. I love this country. I went to law school because I believe in the ideals of liberty and freedom and equal opportunity. And I'm not going to cede those over to a view that only understands those in a mythical way.
Right, right.
And holds the myth out as true for us. Because if we're operating under a myth to solve problems in front of us, well, we're not going to be very successful.
Right, right. So, you know, coming out of second grade and getting to where you are today, what was the epiphanal moment that led you to get into this type of work and research?
Oh my goodness. Well, I truly believe that for most of us that our academic work, our research is somehow biography. Mm-hmm. And so I played basketball. I had as many friends who were of African descent as of European descent. The first person I fell in love with in high school was a young man of African-American descent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, that opened my eyes. That was sort of the first time out of my own experience, I realized that white was a something, right? Because right. before it was just the norm. I didn't see it as a racialized position. Mm-hmm. And certainly that experience was, wow, that was an eye opener.
Wow, I can imagine. So, you know, still, you know, along your journey to getting where you are today, one of the things that I saw about you that I just thought was the most intriguing was that at one time you were a police officer.
Correct.
So tell me about that experience. How did that even come about?
Right. Well, you know what? I was in graduate school at Northwestern University in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I was studying race in this interdisciplinary program. And an undergraduate student, Mark Russ, it's the same old story that is so common to us today. We could fill in the blanks. African-American driving, pulled over by police, unarmed, leaves in a body bag.
Right. Like,
so that was the story of Mark Russ. And I, just a week before Mark was killed, a young African-American woman, LaTanya Haggerty, was unarmed African-American woman shot and killed. And I thought the city was going to be on fire. Like, I just thought people were going to erupt. But Mayor Daley at the time was really able to kind of manage how those police shootings were handled. And both of the officers in both of these cases were themselves African-American. Mm-hmm. And so they were really able to use that to sort of manage emotions. But I was shaken to my core.
Right.
And I wanted to understand how does this keep happening, right? Mm-hmm. And it was also around this time, and I apologize, I'm not sure I can remember her name, but it was a big national search for this woman's children, and she said a Black man had stolen her car. And it turned out that she drove the poor children into a lake and they drowned. All of these things were happening in my world at this time, and I was in graduate school. And so I was actually teaching undergraduate criminal justice courses at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so many of the students were interested in becoming law enforcement officers. So I had taken the police exam, hoping that would help me be a better teacher this group. But then one of the next things that happened were a few police officers showed up at my door to recruit me, encourage me to go along the process. And it was certainly not something I had seriously considered, but they convinced me that, you know, perhaps it would be an opportunity to really make a difference in this environment. So I completed my PhD program and I went into the Chicago Police Department.
Wow. Interesting. I mean, no, that's, I mean, talk about something that just sort of happens. I don't want to say on a whim, but, you know, it's kind of whimsical, if you will.
Not planned, for sure.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, when I saw that, you know, it got me to thinking, you know, about wanting to hear your views as a white person, because, you know, these killings that you talked about and the lady that you were referencing, I can't remember her first name, but I remember her last name was Smith in South Carolina that, you know, accused the Black man of doing that. When we hear people talking about defunding the police, or we talk about and you just sort of mentioned the disproportionate amount of people of color, in particular Blacks, that are killed by the police. Why do you feel that people, and I say people and mostly white people, will retort back with Blue Lives Matter when people talk about Black Lives Matter?
Oh, I just think it is a knee-jerk. That kind of response is pure defensiveness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? Because it's not, and it comes out of the values and habits of whiteness itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A defensive posture. When I'm not defensive, I can just listen to what is said and consider genuinely consider what is being spoken. And so that whole Blue Lives Matter as a response is a knee-jerk defensive response to Black Lives Matter. And it's so unfortunate, but it's also a reflection of whiteness within the broader culture. And if I may, mm-hmm. I think we have to be really clear about what we mean by whiteness. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm X referred to whiteness not as a complexion, but as a state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sociologist Ruth Frankenberg discusses whiteness as this dynamic of social structures that give advantage mm-hmm. to white people, combined with the viewpoints on the part of white people that those advantages shape, and then social norms that emerge out of these three things. And so in a nutshell, whiteness are structures and dynamic practices that persistently and consistently position white people above racialized others. And so if we think of whiteness in that way,
mm-hmm.
I find it super helpful. And of course, it needs to be said that most of us who, when we're born, are labeled white,
mm-hmm.
Often because we are born into this society where that is the norm, the positioning of white people at the top becomes the expected norm.
Right.
We participate in whiteness, reinforcing, reenacting it with relative ease. And in fact, it's often the exception when a person with low levels of melanin, you know, really contests the forces of whiteness.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm thinking back to literally just last night. It's kind of ironic that we're talking today during the pandemic. You know, we couldn't go anywhere, right? So myself and a couple neighbors, we kind of had these, you know, we'll call them happy hours, if you will, on my deck, you know, during the time. And one of the ladies that I was talking with, neighbor, who's white, she attended a diversity training session at her job just recently. I was telling about it last night. And pretty much she was railing on the facilitator, saying that she was not helping us move forward. In my opinion, with what she was saying, it sounded like she wanted to, her personally wanted to deal with the here and now and moving forward. And she felt like the past wasn't relevant. And that as a white person in the room, she felt that she was being attacked and blamed. And I hear that often when we do trainings and stuff like that, that there's a victimness to this. So please explain why, you know, you think she felt that way and why it's important to understand the historical context and, you know, how that gap can be bridged so that, you know, white people don't feel victimized in these training sessions.
Well, look, I'll speak from the I position mm-hmm. in light of my own experience. Look, that is such a common response, and it is derived from being indoctrinated in this view that is unconsciously held that white people are to be positioned at the top mm-hmm. and that we don't see whiteness again as a racial something, right? When oftentimes when we think of race, we think of any other group but white people.
Right, right.
And so us white people really are just submerged as the norm. So I become the norm against which all other racial groups are measured against and considered in relation to. And so that sort of upbringing, to be raised as a person labeled white in that sort of environment, makes it truly shocking when you are confronted with whiteness as a something.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not unlike the Blue Lives Matter response.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely out of a defensive place. And I want to be really clear. It makes sense that people come out of that defensive place. It is not good. We need to address it. But I think it's really important to understand that it makes sense that so many white people, whether they're in blue or not, mm-hmm. have that response. Why is that? Well, it's a reflection of the society, the way in which our lives are organized in the United States of America, that it makes that kind of response, frankly, common. Mm-hmm. What I would love to see is that white people who experience that sort of facilitation in a way that evokes that defensiveness, what mm-hmm. I would love to do with that person is have her become part of a white affinity group. Mm-hmm. So that she can really process, you know, what happens when you look back, and what is that? How are you experiencing that emotively? Mm-hmm. How are you experiencing it? And did you craft those laws? Is it your fault? Is it your parents' and grandparents' fault? You know, this stuff was so deeply embedded by the late 1600s, right on the cusp of the turn of the century, that it's just silly to go into that sort of blame. Mm-hmm. But we do have to understand it so we can move forward productively out of that dynamic of whiteness, to move out of it. What does that mean? Does that mean kill all the white people? No, it means rejecting systems and structures, including our emotional responses, like doing our work to address those, to pay attention to that defensiveness. Look, therapy 101, anytime that defensiveness comes up, there is a lesson for us to learn. Mm-hmm. So we sit down and be quiet and listen both inside and outside.
Yeah.
Number one, right? And then there's 100 other steps, but affinity groups can be a really terrific space if you have a well-trained facilitator. Mm-hmm. To encourage people to ask those sort of questions and to do it in an environment where we're all struggling. You know, we're all looking so many for the first time at this society that we just thought was normal and pretty equal for everybody, and discovering that it's anything but that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still thinking about the conversation, and as it relates to what we're talking about today. And, you know, when she was talking, you know, the terms we and white people. And I think, you know, if it wasn't leading up to our conversation today, I don't think I really would have paid attention to we and white people the way it was said. And it sort of made me think about the title, a part of the title of your book, The Invention of White People. Mm-hmm. So like I'm saying about my friend, I would never say, you know, she's a racist person. I mean, she's definitely has always shown me to be open to anything and everything. But, you know, and even this session that she went to was a volunteer thing. So, you know, here's a person who's, you know, maybe on the surface trying to be an ally. But once they got there, you know, something inside came out that, you know, I don't know if she knew was there or not. So this concept of what you're saying of the invention of white people, how did that happen? You know, how was whiteness invented and why does it matter today?
Yeah, well, there's no way I can give an hour keynote in our time together, but I'll do my best.
The abridged version.
Yeah, I'll do my best. So here's what we know. We know that from the moment the English first sought to colonize in North America, mm-hmm. for 100 years from that point, from the Roanoke attempt, there is not a single reference for 100 years to anyone called a white person, not in mm-hmm. law, not in records, mm-hmm. right? So then all of a sudden, beginning for the first time in 1681, there begins to be a reference to a whole new group of humanity called white people. Well, so the question becomes how, when, where, and why? Like mm-hmm. lawmakers are like the rest of us. You know, we don't tend to go about creating something that requires effort unless it's to serve a purpose. And there's a couple interesting things to note. First of all, before the very first assertion in law of anybody called a white person, the treatment of people of African descent and people of European descent who were indentured servants if they worked on the same plantation, their lives were the same. They were treated the same. They worked together, they ate together, they slept together. What began to emerge around 1640, but even then it was by far the exception, was that some people of African descent began to be claimed as indentured for life or enslaved, which would be our language. But that was, again, the exception, not the rule. And Leon Bennett Jr.'s work is really terrific to capture this, because he, of course, was writing against these white historians who were articulating that the first people of African descent forced to the shores of Virginia were enslaved. But what Lerone Bennett's work shows, because, and he practically takes a picture and puts it in a chapter, he shows that if you look at the records at the plantation, the people of African descent are listed as servants alongside the Europeans who were held on the plantation. And we also know that, only because I've dug into the research about two of those people, is that within 5 years, they were married. You couldn't be married if you were indentured. And so the presumption, the fair assumption, is that they were free. And then they gave birth to a child, which was punishable if you were indentured. And their child, there was no punishment meted out. And the child was, William, was baptized in the Church of England. So you have all of these historical clues that really suggest significantly that people of African descent and European descent were similarly treated. And furthermore, once persons of African descent were free, were no longer bound by a term of indenture, they had the same rights and privileges as an Englishman. They could vote, they could run for public office, and they did. there were African-American men who held public office. They could own land, and they did. They could own European indentured servants. They could own African indentured servants, and they did. All of those things in the historical record. And so then what happened, right? Obviously something significant happened. And what the historical record suggests is that this massive rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion that engulfed the colony of Virginia for over a year.
Right.
Yeah, it is after that rebellion. Again, I think it's really important for people. It's not some week long or a couple day rebellion. It was well over a year that the English ruling elite were absolutely, horrified, traumatized by this. And the work of historian Theodore Allen digs into letters going back and forth between the legal oversight authority in London and the ruling elite in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And the Virginia ruler said, hey, look, oversight authority in London, don't worry about this. We have it under control. And they indicated that they were going to pursue a divide and conquer strategy. And it is on the heels of that that we see bundles and bundles of laws getting passed that took the laboring class and now divided us into those called white laborers. And they didn't do much even on the front end to lift up those white laborers in terms of giving them a pence or resources.
Right.
What they did was they dug out a new bottom to colonial society and tossed people of African descent and indigenous people into that pit. And we've been living with that social structure ever since.
Right, right. Yeah, I actually had a question for you about that. You kind of answered it. But, you know, that sense of divide and conquer mentality is still present today, obviously, in a lot of the laws and practices that we have. So, I want to get into, like I said, a little bit about, our listeners and our audience. You know, a lot of these people are folks on campus that are in their trenches, they're practitioners, senior leaders on campus, folks from PWIs, private, public, elite colleges, community colleges, minority serving institutions. But when I talk to them, and what I often hear for those that are, really getting into the DEI work and getting people on board, that they often are preaching to the choir. So what advice do you have for them to help them to reach those and those, I'm talking, I guess, primarily white people that are stuck or feel like white replacement is really happening in this country? So, you know, how can they bridge that gap?
Yeah. Well, first, let me address one thing that I often hear, which is the whole preaching to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I think Tim Wise said this, but I don't know of any choir that doesn't need daily practice. But
there you go. You know?
Amen. And so, it's okay. You know, it's and look, I've been doing this for more than two decades.
Mm-hmm.
I learn all the time, mm-hmm. and I'm challenged all the time, and. And if I had got this thing down, you know, then everyone who lives around me wouldn't be where they're at, right? We would have moved significantly. So the fact is, even those who are supportive, let's articulate that group in that way, supportive mm-hmm. of DEI, we need to keep going forward with our work and supporting each other, because so many of us feel not a lot of support, or certainly lacking the support that's required. Now, with regard to the replacement theory, folks,
mm-hmm.
you know what? I'll just share my approach. I don't even think so much about that particular group, because I'm really much more concerned with the very significant numbers of people who are on the fence.
Right.
And that's who I try to focus upon. I mean, mm-hmm. If my approaches for that group help those other folks, fantastic. But in my experience, when you have people who are really consciously adhering to, buying into, accepting the ideology of white supremacy,
mm-hmm.
they're a really tough group to move. And I don't want to spew hate on them. But I'm not going to put my energy into them, because I find it not terribly fruitful. So that's my own personal place. So I don't really mm-hmm. have advice for how to approach that particular type of person. But right. I think that we have. Here's the truth. There are many people in this work who disagree with me.
Mm-hmm.
and perhaps I'm. Too optimistic. But in my experience in the world, I find that most people are pretty darn decent.
Right.
But we are in a society and indoctrinated into systems that encourage men to behave badly relative to women because of patriarchy, that cause white people to systematically harm, marginalize, degrade, exclude people of color. And so when you're living in these forces, right, and we could keep going with ableism, with LGBTQ, mm-hmm. There are lots of systems at play. I think if we can really pay attention to the forces around us,
mm-hmm.
for me, it helps me be compassionate to people, even when I'm so frustrated. it allows me, I think, to see that so many people want to get there. I have, in fact, my guess is that your neighbor that you spoke about, who had mm-hmm. that very defensive response again, that there's a part of her that wants something better, but can't even, it doesn't have anything solid yet to grab onto.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
in my experience, people who are so anxious to white women, I think we are particularly bad at this. And again, because of both gender and race indoctrination, mm-hmm. we want to get to the work of changing. But you can't get there until you have changed. It's not possible until I look at how has whiteness shaped my life?
Right.
How has it impacted how I see? How does it impact how I feel on a daily basis?
Right. No, I'm with you on that. And, you know, not that I couldn't say everything I wanted to say in that conversation last night, but there were just some things that I held back. I don't know why. I mean, I could, you know, I guess I do have reasons, but it made me think about something. Another white female colleague of mine said to me one time about bringing those people, like you said, that are on the fence. How do you get them over? And so she was saying to me, at least in her opinion, she felt that they couldn't hear that message from a person like me, a person of color, that it needed to come from a white person. What do you think about that premise?
Well, I am told that is the case, right? Mm-hmm. When I'm brought in to speak on campuses and in schools, I speak oftentimes to seventh and eighth graders as well, mm-hmm. to their parents, that the usually it's a person of color bringing me in, and there is a sense that I can say things that white people will not hear from a person of color.
Right.
And so, you know, when people try there are some folks who say, look, you white people have no business being in this work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we have to be. And right. And it's a job that you want to work yourself out of, you know, like when we don't need white people to say this to white people, because white people can hear cultural critiques and racial critiques of our society and our behavior. You know, that's the world I'm working for, but we're not there, not even close.
Yeah. Gosh, you talk about going into seventh and eighth graders and, you know, in college campuses. So, you know, it kind of makes me shift to thinking about right now the attack that's the assault that's on, you know, critical race theory and all the things that we're talking about. And, you know, again, going back to, you know, I think originally what you were saying, passing laws, you know, that are taking that stuff out of schools. So if this continues, you know, what, you know, kids born today, what do you think their perspective on America is going to be 20 years from now? You know, won't even know about slavery or Jim Crow and redlining and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so far, just over a dozen states have passed these gag order laws.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so frightening to me. I mean, the history that kids were learning on the best campuses was still insufficient,
right.
and very thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so to now have so much history that has to be excluded because somebody may feel guilt because of one's race or gender here's what I know is the result of that will be that our children will not be equipped, will be far less equipped for the global work world that they mm-hmm. are entering. And we are harming our children.
Yeah.
I can tell you that when I go in to speak to seventh and eighth graders, they're not traumatized. Their sense of identity is not crushed.
Right.
It's the parents who have the hard time. And again, I'm not bashing the parents. There's a reason that this is happening and that so many white parents experience learning this history in a way that brings up defensiveness. It's because many of us were raised in a culture that taught us we are to be colorblind, that we don't see race. And unfortunately, too many of us don't know the truth of that it's a fiction, that from the age of 9 months, we see these human gradations in color. And if you look all around us, there's not one measure of a healthy society, from mm-hmm. healthcare to law enforcement, housing, that we don't see along our race lines, this fiction we call race, that this thing called race has an impact in front of us, right? So to pretend that isn't there is to truly be ignorant, to be ignorant. Mm-hmm. And I understand why so many people have that, right? It was ingrained in us, but you know what? It's time. We're adults. It's sort of like do your therapy and grow up. And yes, you may have had a terrible childhood. Your parents may have, you know, abandoned you on in many ways, but you are an adult. Grab hold of your life. Let's face realities and grow. And there's lots of support and help to guide that growth because we desperately need to be able to see what whiteness is. Here's one of the measures that I think is a really good one to present to white people. And that is to ask white people, like, what does it mean to be white? What does that mean? And based upon how well folks can respond to that, that's how I know where my group is at. And it gives me a sense of at least some people in the group. And those who are quiet, that's its own message.
Yeah.
You
know, we're all in this together, right? And, you know, last week in the margins, I talked with Nathan Nguyen, who's the director of the LGBT Center at I think it's Western Michigan University. And we talked a lot about allyship, in particular with the LGBT community. And, you know, for me, it just opened my eyes to, and we talked about what does it mean to be an ally, you know? And I think a lot of people will say they're allies. And I'm not going to put the onus on people of color, but I'm going to ask this question of, you know, like I'm going back to my conversation last night, like how can I or any other BIPOC person in this country be an ally for white people that feel marginalized so that, you know, that they're not attacked, if you will?
Well,
or is it even our place? You know what I mean? Maybe it's not even.
Right. Well, I can't answer that. What I can do is suggest that, you know, this moment where Roe v. Wade is now written off the books and the theory of law that was the hanger upon which Roe v. Wade held now exposes anti-miscegenation laws to be reasserted, laws that prohibited white people from marrying people of African descent and a variety of others, depending on the state, puts same-sex marriage on the line, access to contraceptives, IVF. All of these rights that have been enjoyed for decades, in some cases, are on the fringes at the moment as a matter of law. So to me, this moment is a reminder. When I go back into that history of when white people were invented in colonial North America, when that history reveals that that patriarchy, that the law of coverture that established relations between men and women, that patriarchal order was deployed to create whiteness. And so you have from the emergence of this group called white people, this entanglement of gender hierarchy, race hierarchy, sexuality hierarchies, religion. You can't talk about whiteness in the colonial context and as devoid from Christianity. It's just not possible. So we all of these isms that we experience in society today. They are intertwined. And the sooner we're able to do our own internal work, right? So just like white people have to confront our whiteness within ourselves, all our other groups have to, all of us have to confront homophobia in ourselves, our adoption of patriarchy within ourselves, like that same kind of work has to be done in all these different ways. You know, the Islamophobia, you name it, we have that work to do. And when we can be in that work, because the other piece of it is that it's never done. We're on a path together, and for me, I experience people as an ally. along that LGBTQ path or gender equality path, for example, mm-hmm. when you're on the path, right? When there's evidence that you're on the path, and when you mess up, which I mess up, you know, mm-hmm. with some disturbing frequency, that I can take responsibility for it. I can apologize. I can seek to ask for a conversation so that there's growth and that, you know, we support each other through this, right? I have this terrific, what my closest friend from graduate studies is an African-American woman. And, you know, through the decades subsequent to graduating with our PhDs, she'll call me and say, Jackie, talk to me about your white people, you know, fill me in, like, help me understand.
Yeah.
And how beautiful, right? And I can call her and I say, you know, Dr. Johnson, talk to me about straight Christian people, please fill mm-hmm. me in. What's going on here? How is this working? And because we love each other, you know, this is a human being who, even when I say something that I'm hearing that feels like really offensive, she could say, like, hold on, now let's talk through this, right? And we can do that with each other. And that's what we just need, more of that. We need more relationships that we can allow missteps because we know we care and that we're on the path. We're not going to stay there. We're going to move and mm-hmm. support each other and be understanding.
Yeah. You know, it got me thinking, I mean, all the things you just were talking about, Roe v. Wade, et cetera, you know, our conversation last night, you know, evolved into, you know, almost all those topics you just mentioned. And my neighbor and I, you know, we are good friends and we both were on the same path. It was just, you know, I think we just had that little bit of a diversion, if you will. But with your legal background, this was something that came up last night and it's somewhat digressing from our conversation. But, you know, in the Roe v. Wade decision, and now when you bring up the slippery slope that it puts us on, I was saying last night, I got to look this up because I'm trying to figure out what did the Supreme Court use as a basis? What in our Constitution says that they can take that right away? You know, where is that written? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, they don't have to have that. It's mm-hmm. implicit in the role of the Supreme Court, okay. right? The role of the Supreme Court is to uphold the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so they're taking this originalist position with regard to the Constitution, which is fundamentally flawed because, look, we don't know what. While we may have some written documents about how some of those who crafted certain sections of the Constitution, their particular thinking, mm-hmm. we may understand that. But the Constitution did not become the Constitution until it got votes from the majority, from the collective, right? And we don't know their thinking. We don't know why they supported it. We don't know what they were thinking, right? That's why this original intent approach is mm-hmm. just flawed, but it holds a lot of political weight. Lots mm-hmm. of people who don't understand how the courts work are like, oh, well, we want to follow the Constitution. They're following the Constitution. But that particular approach to law, first of all, they pick and choose mm-hmm. pieces of society they want to go back to, first of all. So that in itself reveals a disingenuous originalist position, at least as I have observed these lawmakers. And it treats the Constitution as if it was not crafted to adjust to time, to mm-hmm. how society evolves and changes, right? So these are the two different views of law that are at play. One views law as like language. Think about language. We have new words emerging all the time, but anytime you have a new word coming out, mm-hmm. It doesn't cause a slippery slope that, oh my God, the English language now it's gone. It's in the dumps, right? We've allowed a new word, or we've taken away a word, or a word like gay has changed meaning over time, mm-hmm. right? Language is dynamic. In fact, we know that if language does not change, it dies. Mm-hmm. So I'm an adherent to a view of law and the role of the judge and the Constitution as like language. Because if it's not taking into account society as a whole and where things are moving and adjusting to that, it's no longer serving the people. And that's the fundamental purpose of the Constitution. Right. But the originalists view law as like the game of chess. Right. Mm-hmm. Nothing changes. Every piece has a specific and we all agree on it, which itself is a false presumption. So those are the different views of law being battled for in the courts.
Yeah. You know, I think it's important, and thank you for bringing that home. But, you know, I look at the work that you're doing and others doing that, you know, where you're pointing out these anti-racist policies and practices. So, you know, I think it's good that you guys do that, that you continue doing that and to help us move forward. You know, and I've been working at Diverse for 30 years, you know, looking at reading about inequities in higher education and around this country. But, you know, cynically, I think and I look back, I'm like, gosh, in my lifetime, I feel like as a country, we've taken 3 steps forward, 2 back, 1 forward, 2 back. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I feel like I was born in 1968. I feel like we're really right at the same place. You know, nothing has really changed. So, and I look at things that we've covered in Diverse over the years. I can pull things that we covered in the 80s and we covered again in the 90s, again in the 2000s, and now the same thing in the 2020. So cynically, I say the stuff's not working. So, you know, what new ideas or frameworks or policies do you think need to be changed or adjusted so that, you know, 30 years from now, my children aren't saying the same thing?
Wow, that's the golden bullet there.
Right.
So, you know what, Ralph, we need to do everything. There's no one way, right? We've had these battles more recently about, okay, it's policy that we focus on. Forget the hearts and minds. And then others are like, no, we need the hearts and minds. We need both. Because here's what history has shown us. If you just change the policy, then you have white rage is what Carol Anderson calls it, which is exactly what we're seeing right now, right? Legislation being passed to ensure that the promise of anti-racist policies and practices will never be realized. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we have gag order legislation. Carol Anderson refers to that as white rage. So we have to keep working on changing hearts and minds, and we have to keep working on policy and practices. And we also need a focus on parenting. How do you do this parenting to have conversations with kids early so that they're not, so that they can, white children in particular, because children of color are going to learn to see race, to talk about race, because they have to, right? Survival. Right. And white people get to just say, oh, they're too young. I want to keep them innocent. Well, boy, what a privilege. What a privilege. But the unfortunate part of adopting that privileged stance with regard to our kids is the result is that the dominant culture fills in where we don't. And so the messages of whiteness as superior, that's the message our kids are getting. Mm-hmm. Not because a teacher is saying that, but because 80% of teachers are white, right? Mm-hmm. Those the how whiteness works in these multitude of ways, from who we see in positions of leadership, you know, who our teachers are, from the values and habits that shape our institutions, those are all coming out of whiteness. And I mean, you know, we could go on and on. I think about on the college campuses, people are always asking me, you know, like, well, where is whiteness in our classrooms? And I just really encourage people, because to me, the better question is where isn't whiteness?
Right.
Because it's everywhere. And so, and I know for most people, they look at me like a deer in the headlights. And I say, well, for example, let's say you're reading a text and the author of the text is Frederick Douglass, right? An African-American historical leader. And when you're reading about him, you're talking about how his position as African-American, as a Black man in this context, is shaping his writing. And everybody says, yeah, of course. And I said, well, when you're reading about Benjamin Franklin, or you're studying Benjamin Franklin, what we're not doing, and this is the working of whiteness, is not asking, well, how did his whiteness, how did being seen as a white person, being labeled as a white person, mm-hmm. shape how he thought, why he wrote what he wrote, right? Because we're totally, when we fail to do that, right? When mm-hmm. we fail to do that, what we do in our minds is we allow the position of whiteness to continue to pass as the norm. It doesn't get questioned. And if we're not questioning it, whiteness continues. We have, it seamlessly passes to the next generation without critique.
No, you're right. And you're making me think about conversations that I've had over the years with, you know, my white friends, and they talk about how they grew up. And when we talk about, you know, whiteness and all that, the common response almost to a person has been, we didn't talk about that in my family. We didn't talk about that. Or, you know, my parents always said, treat everybody the same. And they didn't understand, you know, where this hostility comes in and all that kind of stuff. And so, no, you're right. I think parenting is a big part of it. And, you know, too many people leave parenting to the schools, you know, and other people. So right. You're right. Those conversations need to be had at home. We will get towards the end of time here. And I do, again, thank you for your time. But I just want to close with just two thoughts from you. I want you to complete these last two sentences. The first one is, I think white fragility is
so important to be aware of so that we can do the internal work of dismantling the workings of whiteness in how we behave every day.
Okay. Only if white America would, or if only, I'm sorry.
See the truth of our history so that we could understand why our society is the way it is, why we have learned what we have learned. When you understand the history from my perspective, the defensiveness just melts because you see so clearly that it's not your fault. There's
right.
We are the product of this very complex system. And when we can start to see it, then we can make different choices. And it changes. It changes. I'll speak from the eye. It has changed me from my core. It has changed how I see the past, how I make sense of the present, and how I even imagine the future. And I'm such a better human being because of it.
Right, right. Thank you, Dr. Badalora, for sharing your thoughts and your perspectives. I think they're invaluable. So hopefully we will stay in touch.
Thanks. I would love that. Ralph, thank you so much. Thank you for doing what you do. So needed.